Thanks, Ken. I really appreciate the invitation to speak. You know, it's always an honour to do so, and appreciate particularly my first time at a secular meeting. Welcome everyone to the meeting for the first time. Thanks to everyone doing service. I guess, you know, what I want to start with is just saying that I'm not only a secularist, I'm also an anti-spiritualist. And what I mean by that is I'm actually hostile to any notions of spirituality. And I say that because I don't want to, some of my ideas and the reasons for that, which I'll detail in a second, probably come a little bit dangerously close to breaking tradition 10. And I just want to make note of that because I don't want to offend people. And the reason, there's a few different reasons why I'm anti-spiritualist. So one of them is what I see to be duplicity and this idea that people hide behind spirituality. So some of the most ardent spiritualists that I've encountered have also been the most horrible people. And the one that I start off with is my father. And my father was a raving spiritualist. He'd talk about the amazing qualities of Buddha and Jesus, and you know, all those bastions of goodness, and yet he was the most horrible human being imaginable. So imagine the worst kind of things that a human could be, and he was those things. And you know, I've got plenty of other examples. People know who are on my Facebook how much I've had disdain for Russell Brand. For a while, are these just full of hot air and pseudo profundity? So talking about things that sound deep but actually aren't. And of course, it's just come out that he's his fifth sexual assault charge. And same thing with Deepak Chopra. It's just come out. I've always hated him, and it's just come out that he's had communication with Jeffrey Epstein. So just examples of people who profess to be spiritual, but underneath, they're really quite ugly human beings. So that's kind of been my experience. And look, maybe that's not everyone's experience. I have also had experience with people who profess to be religious and spiritual, but are also beautiful human beings. But to me, that's just that's not a necessary coincidence. I think you can be that without being spiritual. To me, that's just an appended label to a person that's just that way by nature. So I guess, you know, the other reasons are that I see that spirituality, I'm quite a logical person. And I admit that, you know, part of that is that I'm dissociated from my emotions, and part of my recovery is amalgamating my emotional life with my logical life. But I see, for example, that, you know, a lot of spirituality is built on, for example, logical fallacies and cognitive biases. And, you know, one of them that I really struggle with listening to the room is people saying, oh, you know, I'm here for a reason. You know, I was spared for a reason. I find that, you know, horribly self-centered, you know, thinking that, you know, all the people that have died, but it's also based on the survivorship bias, this idea that, you know, you're only sampling from the people that have actually survived and not sampling from the people who have died. And this idea that we're here for a reason, which is the teleological fallacy, this idea that there's some kind of intentional agent that's built on this idea that there is this supervising intentional agent in the universe. And so those are kind of some of the reasons. And also, you know, I've done a bit of investigating and looked at the fact that there, you know, the schism between religion and spirituality is actually fairly recent. And most people who I identify as spiritual are also religious. And we're probably on the vanguard here, you know, in terms of being secularists, where, you know, we are spiritual and not religious in a lot of cases. But, you know, all that logical stuff aside, I want to admit that, you know, my metaphysical world is a reflection of my psychosocial emotional world. And, you know, looking at my formative years were built around themes of abandonment, anxiety and depression. And so my earliest years, I experienced a sense of just chronic emptiness. And so I've been retrospectively diagnosed with having depression as a child. And I think it was just part of my constitution. It was also part of the environment that I was raised in. So my mum was very depressed. She'd left my father very early, seeing the warning signs that he was the man that he was, and she was very depressed. And we're just containers for for our parents' disposition when we're that age, because there's very much a symbiosis between parent and child. And so I really took on my mum's disposition, and so I felt this chronic sense of threat from the world. I was very anxious, as I said, and actually that was one of the ways that I actually relieved my anxiety. Was one of the first ways that I encountered my addiction. I remember going to a birthday party when I was about 4 or 5 and discovering sugar, and I ended up eating something like 15 cupcakes. And I remember one of the parents being absolutely disgusted. She'd never seen anything like it, but I remember just the relief that I got from having the sugar and just not having to feel that anxiety for quite some time. But one thing that I never had, the other thing I want to go back is to those themes of abandonment, in the sense that my dad never sought a connection with me. And you could look at it as being this idea that, for example, if I'd had a template of relationship with a deity, then maybe I would have had sorry with a father, then maybe I would have had a sense of a deity being in my life, but maybe I wouldn't have, because as I said, I'd never had an impulse. And I think it's mentioned in literature and in another fellowship that we've all got an impulse to a deity, but I've never experienced that, so I'd like to reject that idea. But one thing I want to mention, and I'm going to touch on mental health, even though this isn't a mental health meeting, is that early in my years, I developed very severe OCD, and there's a type of OCD that's built around religious ideas, and I became incredibly fearful of the idea of demonic, Satan and demons and all that sort of thing. And so I had to cross myself several times a night, say prayers, and it was pretty scary, because when it's metaphysical, there's no ailment. You feel like there's no way of being kind of there's no reprieve for that. But I managed to get over that, thankfully. But once again, as I said, I had no real affinity for religion. Other than that, my best mate was his dad was a pastor, and of course he was an arsehole. So another example of people setting a poor example who are spiritual and religious. And I often went to church with him, but it was an intellectual curiosity for me. It wasn't something that I ever felt viscerally. And at about 14, I started using. And this idea that somehow that using is to fill some void left by a higher power is, I don't know, it's a bit clunky for me. It depends on what you mean by higher power. So one thing that I've come to understand is that with religion, religion, higher power, and spiritual notions, they're what I call Ptolemaic epicycles. So there was this, an astronomer called Ptolemy, and he wanted to preserve this notion that the Earth was the center of the universe, so a geocentric model. And by doing that, he had to take into account that the planets did these weird motions, because of course they go around the sun. So he invented these little circles that they do, these quick little circles, to make it fit the model. And to me, that's how spirituality is. It's this unnecessary overlay, this complicated overlay, to make it fit the model, so that I'm smack bang in the middle, and that I've got this special relationship with a higher power. And to me, it's just not necessary. When I break it down to its constituent parts, they're just very simple things that, and you could also say doing that way, you're also overcomplicating it. But to me, there's just no room for it. So I've looked at what is actually needed, and I went in and looked at this paper, for example, this reverend, and he looked at spirituality and the secular elements, and he was able to pull out 13 different parts, which we address as part of the steps anyway. And so there's no need to talk, very very abstractly about a higher power. There's things like I actually wrote them down because I didn't want to forget them. But it's meaning, purpose, values, humanity, self-knowledge, and these are all things we work on anyway. So I don't, to me, a relationship with a higher power isn't necessary. So I'm just trying to think where I was with that. So this idea that, I'm filling a gap with a substance might be taken to mean that I've got a loss of a sense of meaning and purpose in life, that, I am missing self-knowledge. I'm missing those elements that, for example, this reverend had broken down into a higher power, as being constituent parts of a higher power. But to me, that's still a little bit tenuous. If you look at, I think, there are some commonalities across people and why they use. But me, I was using because of my mental health, like I was just in a lot of pain because of my mental health. And, part of it was because I wanted to connect with people as well. And, it helped me with connection. So that's a commonality. But I stopped using at about 23 initially. And that's because I did find that meaning and purpose. I found it through study. It was a very fit my personality really well. It was psychology and neuroscience. And once again, I found then working in a field examining brain death, I was confronted with more evidence that told me that there was no real kind of evidence for like a soul. I remember seeing a person who had a heart attack and who was basically a zombie. And so they moved and they did everything that a human being would do, but there was just nothing there. They had complete brain death. And I remember just thinking, wow, there's just nothing there. This guy's just a meat sack. But he felt pain. And I just had plenty of those sort of experiences. For me, my recovery now is about coming to terms with some of those more uncomfortable truths. So I've had, horrendous last 4 years. So to just put it in a nutshell, I've had two of my sorry, I've had my res my number one reservation has happened twice, and so I ended up having a brain injury, and I've always seen myself as a bit of as someone who's identified with being intellectual. So having a brain injury, I've lost 7 years of my memory or more, and I struggle to make new memories. So I don't recognize people, and it's the most terrifying experience I could ever imagine. It's just been absolutely horrific. I don't know. And people who know me have said you're worse now than when you were using. And so, the way that I'm trying to navigate it is doing those things which I mentioned, those principles that Cook talked about, which is finding meaning and purpose. So I'm trying to now advocate for it was a medical procedure that actually caused it, and it was to do with mismanagement. And so, now I'm turning it into this my meaning and purpose, which is to advocate for people and to try and stop, this from happening again. I'm connecting with people. I get a sense of meaning from my sense of relatedness, which was another principle that came out from this survey of 12-step literature, sorry. So relatedness by connecting with others in service. So I'm doing some really meaningful service at the moment. So on the safety committee, which is looking at bullying and predatory behavior. And look, I don't believe that I'm taken care of. It's funny how even though I am not a spiritualist, how my thinking falls back into the kind of cognitive biases which I dislike. So since all this stuff's happened, I've started personalizing or anthropomorphizing the universe. And so, obviously the way I understand it, the universe is very indifferent. It doesn't have anything against me and it's not looking after me. But with all these things happening, I've fallen back on that idea of karmic thinking. And of course, I know there's no such thing as karmic thinking. Otherwise, you wouldn't have innocent, children suffering, or you wouldn't have people who do terrible things getting off scot-free, for instance. And I know the kind of biases it's based on, but it's funny how I keep on looking into my past, trying to work out how I deserve, what I've done to deserve it. And it's my way of trying to make sense of what's happened. And also, just trying to understand, why. But I've got to challenge that thinking that there is no why. It's actually connected to my mental health. The treatment was related to my mental health, and that's no one's fault. So I'm trying to challenge that. And look, I don't know what's going to happen. We've got that whole idea of hold on, pain ends. It fluctuates. And so does my gratitude. They say, a grateful addict is a clean addict. Well, I think, for me, gratitude fluctuates. There's days where I'm not grateful to be clean. But, there are days when I'm grateful, and I just have to hold on to those. But there are benevolent, even though there isn't a benevolent transcendent entity in my life, there are benevolent influences. So I've got my sponsor. Obviously, I've got the fellowship. I would, yeah, whether you could call them a higher power, I don't know if you can do the substitution that they talk about. I've crossed out higher power in all my NA literature, because reading it, there is definitely a bias towards a theistic interpretation. And I've tried to do the substitution and it just doesn't work. It's just too clunky, because the reference is always, or well, mostly transcendent and spiritual in nature. So to me, I just look at it that, because the fellowship, to me, the literature and the people in my life are fallible. They make mistakes. I can beat myself over the head with literature, and it can be, particularly in my experience of another fellowship, it can be quite punitive, the program. There are elements within the fellowship that can be quite malevolent if I'm not careful, and I've got to protect myself from certain people. And the other people in my life, psychologists, psychiatrists, they make mistakes, and so I've got to be accommodating of that. So it's different to the idea of a higher power. So I've just got to be a little bit more flexible in my thinking. But I've introduced enough in my life, I think, to get me through. And I just have to focus on some of the other things very quickly, is self-awareness and humanity. I see the universe as being completely without humanity, and how do I combat that? Well, the greatest I guess rebuke and rebellion is to be as human as possible. So I try and be as compassionate as and as generous and as loving as I can in an inhuman universe, and that's my rebellion. And I've been told that, against conventional wisdom, my anger and my intellect are my greatest assets, and I can use them as part of my transformation and as part of my, gift, to to others. How I can fuel my contribution to others. So anyway, thank you for letting me share. I really appreciate it.